This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last week's fatal shooting at Miami International Airport involved two federal air marshals and a man who officials say acted eccentrically, claimed to have a bomb, and refused to obey instructions shouted at gunpoint. It turns out he did not have a bomb, and officials now say that the man suffered from mental illness. Law enforcement, and usually the police, are often the first to arrive when someone is having a psychiatric crisis, and all too often the results are tragic. Officers must sometimes make split-second decisions about the intentions and the mental stability of someone who can appear to be very dangerous. In this hour, we'll talk with a police official in Memphis, Tennessee, which pioneered a pilot program to teach officers how to respond effectively to calls involving the mentally ill, and we'll talk with a forensic psychiatrist who's trained the U.S. Secret Service. And we want to hear from you. If you have a mentally unstable loved one who's had a run-in with the law, or if you're an officer who has first-hand experience with this issue, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Later in the program, the background to the racial tension that erupted in Sydney, Australia this past week. But first, law enforcement and mental illness, and we're joined now by Major Sam Cochran, coordinator of the Crisis Intervention Team with the Memphis Police Department. He joins us from the studios of member station WKNO in Memphis, and it's nice to have you on the program, Major.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you having me.
And I know you stress that normal police procedures and protocols will not work when you encounter a person with mental illness. How come?
Well, when you say normal, I think maybe some of the traditional training is not at the level that would best handle some crisis episodes that involve mental illness issues.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
I think it takes unique talents, definitely a comprehensive understanding of the issues that are involved. A certain degree of passion and commitment to working with this particular population.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've set up a system, not just extra training for certain officers, but why don't we begin with that, extra training for certain officers? What are they trained to do? What do they hope to do in the street?
Well, we refer to the program as the Crisis Intervention Team, and oftentimes it's reverted to the letters CIT.
Mm-hmm.
And the CIT program has specific goals. It starts with officers that volunteer to be a part of this particular team. There's also a selection process. We're looking for that level of officers that they're already at sale within their skills as a law enforcement officer. And then we add more to their talents. It's an understanding of about mental illness issues, but it's also their understanding of how they fit into the crisis program or into the crisis event itself.
Mm-hmm.
And it requires leadership, it requires talents. The training is comprehensive. The actual training is 40 hours of training. Of course, that's the introduction part of the training. We also have follow-up training hours that supplement officers as they continue in their performance as a CIT officer.
And there are other agencies involved. Indeed, a special psychiatric emergency room has been set up. And obviously, a critical part of this is to train dispatchers, 911 and people who answer the phones.
Absolutely, and these are some of the I think some of the things that you're bringing up, such as the emergency room triage cooperations that we have within our local mental health system, and the dispatchers. Those are very important, but there's also many subcategories that are also important, and I think that our officers present themselves as a specialist, but they also present themselves as the heartbeat of the community and the reflection of what the community feels is necessary in dealing with these types of crisis events.
What prompted the creation of the crisis intervention teams?
Well, the actual, I think, the focal point that really come to the attention of the community happened in 1987. It actually started prior to that in 86, but let me start with the 87 event. In 1987, our dispatchers received a call that information was given that the individual had a mental illness. So we knew on the front end that the individual had a mental illness. We was also given that the individual was armed with a very large knife, and that the individual was cutting himself and making threats against family members that were present and also other neighbors. After our officers were dispatched and after a brief encounter with this individual was shot multiple times and as a result of that shooting had died, which then brought about an outcry from our community with regards to really questioning whether or not everything was done under those circumstances. And the outcry was so intense in 1987, It then spilled over into the political arena, you know, I might add, from the standpoint of view that our mayor got actively involved at that particular time and summoned a community task force of individuals together to look at issues that really played a part in crisis response. And specifically, it was looking for resolutions that would provide safety for the officers, safety for family members, and safety for consumers of mental health services, those that may be experiencing a crisis pertaining to their mental illness. And so that was approach to address this from a community level really helped to bring about credibility to something that was really necessary, that was in our community, that existed, but I don't think was really recognized by many within the community. Which brings me, and I know I'm a little long on this, but
okay.
let me add up the 1986. In 1986, our family members, which is really an organization of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, they're the ones that recognized that there was issues pertaining to crisis events that they were familiar with, that they really, from the Memphis police perspective, they distrusted. They had fear and trepidation about calling our officers to events that were to happen. And so they began an active role to make changes within our community. Only I'm afraid that from their voice, which was, I think, laid the foundations for other things to happen, mm-hmm. but it was not acted on immediately. What they expressed to our community leaders and through our police administrators at that time in 86 was that your officers are not trained. They kept repeating that over and over in their message, your officers are not trained. However, and I want you to make note of this, actually, the Memphis police officers in 1986 were well-trained within the standards of that particular time. In fact, our officers were trained with 8.5 hours of training, which was at the high scale of national training hours that were presented to law enforcement officers pertaining to mental illness. Not only that, the training was being conducted by professional mental health people that were contracted through our local mental health center. And so we felt very confident that we were trained, but mm-hmm. I think that
obviously it was not that their warning seemed prophetic in light of the events of 1987, right?
I think so.
Yeah. Well, let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's talk with Damien. Damien calling from Trenton in New Jersey.
Yes, how you doing?
Very well. How are you?
Good. I just wanted to let you know that I'm like this subject because I have a brother that is has a mental illness, and recently he had an altercation where he wasn't taking his medicine, and my father called the police so they can get him to get some help,
mm-hmm.
and in that and that resulted to when the cops came, they didn't know how to handle him, a cop got hurt. And the result of this, he's in the county jail right now, and they're charging him with resisting arrest and bodily harming an officer. And when they, we called them, we already told them that he was, mentally ill.
Mm-hmm.
So right now he's in a county jail where he's not even supposed to be at right now. He's supposed to be like trans psychiatric. They didn't even give him a 30-day evaluation. I'm just saying that it's a lot of this going on. When the officers come, they don't know. Basically, like you're saying, they need to be trained how to handle situations like this.
And Major Cochran, a situation like Damien is describing, that's exactly what this program was set up to try to deal with, right?
Exactly right. I'm afraid that the truth of the matter is that this what he is relating to you is happening way too frequent across the United States of America.
And just to be careful, and Damien, we certainly hope your brother recovers and does well, but obviously in a bit of a fix there in Trenton. So good luck.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. But obviously, from time to time, officers are not going to know in advance that this is a psychiatric crisis incident. 20% of people with psychiatric illnesses have never been diagnosed.
That's true. I mean, many times information that may be coming in through the police dispatch with today's world with cell phones, individuals that may be calling may not know anything other than some type of disturbance is occurring. And so the dispatchers are not going to know very much information at all about what the disturbance might be. We would like to have information on the front end as much as possible about whatever the event is happening, but also if individuals are familiar with the person that may be in a crisis, to articulate and to give information pertaining to their history surrounding that of maybe a mental illness that they may be having. And that's important.
Would dispatchers have the authority to say, look, nobody said as much, but, you know, this sounds like it might involve a mental illness. We should send a CIT officer?
Absolutely. I appreciate you recognizing that. A lot of times information will come in that the individual call person may not know themselves as the history of an individual, as already mentioned, but the fact that the dispatcher sometimes has to make judgment decisions on their part. You know, this sounds like, they may be saying, this mm-hmm. sounds like a person that may be in crisis pertaining to mental illness. And so sometimes they will dispatch a crisis intervention team officer to a particular call event on the pretext that it sure sounds like that mental illness may be a factor.
We're talking with Major Sam Cochran of the Memphis Police Department of that city's crisis intervention team. More about what happens when police encounter the mentally ill after a break. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, email totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing crisis situations that involve mentally ill people and law enforcement. Still with us is Major Sam Cochran. He's coordinator of the crisis intervention team with the police department in Memphis, Tennessee. And let's see if we get another caller on the line. This is Mark. Mark calling us from Hollywood, Florida.
Yes. I was calling because I have a sister-in-law that was recently arrested by the police. She did not have a history of mental illness prior to her arrest. This was up in Boca Raton. Fortunately, the police were very understanding at the time. They didn't overreact. They were able to take her to the proper place, and she was institutionalized for a short period of time, diagnosed correctly, and things turned out well. So there are good things that happen. Unfortunately, you know, with this recent thing with the airplane, it seems like most people have the attitude that mentally ill people are not citizens and they're criminals, and they're not really given the correct opportunity to participate in the system as citizens and be respected as citizens and expect police to treat them well as citizens.
Interestingly, Major Cochran, when you were describing the crisis intervention team, you were talking about consumers of mental health services.
And that's right. And let me add to the call. The caller just made a comment. Boca Raton and West Palm Beach, which is their neighbor, both have the crisis intervention team program, and then the community is doing an outstanding job for their community and perspective with law enforcement and the partnerships they have. With regards to let me see if I can answer, go back to some of the training issues that are important.
Mm-hmm.
The training that we have is 40 hours of training, and part of the training that we have in that 40 hours is 8 hours of training that our officers interact with consumers, and they go to to different facilities throughout our community here in Memphis, and they see the and meet consumers at different levels and different walks of life, and they get a better perspective of who the consumers are. And a lot of times, I might add, that and not just law enforcement, but the communities that we live in and our nation as a whole, oftentimes there's a tremendous amount of stigma that's associated with mental illness and our perception as to who are the mentally ill. And I'm afraid many times the mentally ill are perceived to always be violent and always being always dangerous and always out to kill someone. And that's just not true. And yet I think the stigma has permeated our culture and our community so intensely, and I might add that law enforcement is a part of the community, that it negatively influences our actions to try to resolve a crisis or to try to interpret what the crisis is really about. Mm-hmm. And so when we go through training and we're interacting with the consumers, we are there for the purpose of meeting consumers and for the consumers to meeting our officers. We go in small groups. We have a facilitator that's responsible to opening up the dialogues between the two groups. I call it having our nervous police officers meet our nervous consumers. and it's very beneficial. And it, from the beneficial from the standpoint of view is, from a law enforcement's perspective, we always see the worst in people in crisis. And from a consumer standpoint of view, they're in a serious crisis episode and always sometimes present themselves in a negative context. And not to mention this tremendous amount of fear that's present. So that's hard to work with and hard to get over some of those issues. And by having our officers to meet the consumers and to better understand, it gives them a better perspective of the human side of some of the issues pertaining to mental illness. And it also gives opening up the dialogues for our consumers to ask officers questions. Why do they do mm-hmm. some of the things that they perceive them doing, and sometimes perceiving the officers doing things inappropriately? And the officers are able to ask questions, too, as to with regards to their experiences in a crisis episode and what's really going on and what they might be able to do to assist an individual in a crisis. So this kind of training is very beneficial. It's we see different levels. We always go to, we're fortunate we have a state hospital in our community. We go to individuals and meet individuals in our state hospital who are very sick and recovering. But we also go to mental health centers. We go to clubhouses. We go and meet different individuals where their consumers are trying to be gainfully employed, and they sit down and open dialogue and discuss hopes, dreams, fears, frustrations, relationships, something that we all have opinions on and something that we all experience.
Mark, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you very much.
And Major Cochran, thank you very much for being with us today. We appreciate it. Good luck with the program.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sam Cochran is a coordinator of the Crisis Intervention Team with the Police Department in Memphis, Tennessee, and he joined us today from studios of member station WKNO in Memphis, Tennessee. On the line with us now is Dr. Robert Phillips, a forensic psychiatrist and author of Psychiatry and Law and professor of psychiatry and law at the University of Maryland. He's also a psychiatric consultant to the Protective Intelligence Division of the U.S. Secret Service, and he joins us from his office in Annapolis, Maryland. Good to have you on the program, sir.
Good to be here. Thank you very much.
I wonder if you've seen an evolution within federal law enforcement agencies over how to interact with the mentally ill.
I think there's no question that federal law enforcement and state law enforcement as well has appreciated many of the things that the Major was describing earlier in your segment.
Mm-hmm.
The need to become better skilled at identifying the signs and symptoms of mental illness that will lead to a better and more favorable outcome when law enforcement is asked to intervene, I think has become bread and butter of the training in most state and federal law enforcement agencies around the country.
But obviously the use of a split-second decisions is paramount for Secret Service agents.
I think that would be true in the context of the job that they do when protecting the president or a head of state. But the same is true at state and local level. It all depends on the context.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're talking in terms of the crisis intervention teams of the police department, where they get a call in advance that this may involve someone with a mental problem. Secret Service may not get that kind of warning.
Well, that's right. And I think that's my point of context. You know, if someone runs out onto I-95 during the middle of rush hour, there's a very high probability they're going to be struck by a car,
mm-hmm.
whether or not that person suffers from a mental illness. So context is important. By the same token, if you think of the situation where a law enforcement officer is called to a person's home because of a domestic dispute or some other altercation, there are going to be broader parameters and much more time in which they're going to be able to think about and employ and use some of the things that they've learned because the context is different. Contrarily, if someone is advancing against the president or a head of state, jumps over the secure perimeter and is running towards them with a backpack and reaches in the backpack and refuses to cease and desist, law enforcement may have a much narrower parameter and scope in which they have to act.
Mm-hmm.
Same would be true of TSA agents if a similar circumstance occurred. So you have to think about law enforcement's response in the context. And the training is going to be useful only if it's contextually compatible.
Now, there have been a few incidents in the past years of people jumping over the fence at the White House, even opening fire at the White House. Officers obviously have to respond extremely carefully.
That's correct.
You could get hurt.
That's right. And again, those kinds of situations are in which we've seen law enforcement respond, the response is dictated by the circumstance. That is a very different situation from what we were hearing earlier in the mm-hmm. broadcast when a crisis intervention team is called or if there is the ability to work and negotiate with the individual. So it all depends on the situation. But what is clear is that the training and the understanding of how to deal with someone who suffers from a mental illness, or for that matter, anyone who is exhibiting signs and symptoms of an altered mental state. You know, you don't have to have a mental illness in order to exhibit signs and symptoms of altered mental states.
Mm-hmm.
People who are using drugs, people who may be having adverse reactions to medications that have been prescribed. All of these things are now in the arsenal of understanding of law enforcement officials who have to interact with the public in very high-risk situations on a day-to-day basis.
I think there's an unfortunate corollary to that. Just because someone may be mentally ill does not mean they're not dangerous.
Well, that's correct. But just because someone is not mentally ill doesn't mean they are not dangerous. And so the reality is, regardless of what the underlying issue is, law enforcement officers have to react to the individual in the situation, and they have to pay attention to the signs and symptoms and the presentation of behavior in the context in which they are confronted. At the extent to which they have the time and availability to identify these issues and work with the individual and try and talk them down or whatever the circumstance may be, those are the skills that they rely upon. But we do get to a point where that circumstance may not be possible.
Mm-hmm.
And the tolerances that are set because of situation or circumstance have to be recognized, at which point law enforcement must default to a protocol that is designed to essentially protect the broader society at large.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Alladay. Alladay calling us from Oakland, California.
Hi, I would like to disagree with the speaker that you actually have on because I agree to the point that a very small percentage of people with mental illness are involved in the type of high-profile situations that he's described. The majority encounters with the police, however, are police coming into an environment, as was your previous speaker alluding to, where the police are encountering someone, and then they normally escalate the situation. I personally have lost a father who was a retired school teacher when the police showed up after being called by social services. And when the police got there, as opposed to de-escalating the situation, they continued to push the situation until my father was eventually shot and killed.
Mm-hmm.
So when the gentleman that's speaking now, your guest who's talking about how the police need to respond, well, if you looked at all of the reports after the situation in Florida, all of the witnesses described a situation where there was escalation on the side of the officers. And there was a part to coerce the witnesses to say that the gentleman said the B word, the bomb, when that wasn't the case. So what I would look at it from a different perspective, and I would wonder where the responsibility after culpability on the law enforcement is assumed that they are held accountable.
I think the situation in which your father was involved is different from the one that the air marshals faced in Florida, and I think is different from the one that Dr. Phillips is describing with Secret Service agents.
And
again,
I agree, and I agree wholeheartedly they're different, but the point is that even in all police shootings, the FBI, through the direction of the Department of Civil Rights, does the investigations for the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
And what you'll find is a very inept policy in regards to getting to the bottom of these shootings. It's the same. And when I read that report and I seen that the witness were saying that they were being asked, did they hear the B word? And they didn't know what the B was. And they told them bomb. And then when they said no, it wasn't good enough for the law enforcement. They're constantly trying to protect their backs. And that's not going to get to the solution. Now, I have to agree with your previous guest. We consulted him on the Monterey Peninsula, and we also now have the police and the sheriffs, and the whole county is required to go through the training. And it was based on the model out of Memphis.
Good. Thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And Dr. Phillips, again, I think he was drawing the distinction between a crisis situation, perhaps like the air marshals faced in Miami or Secret Service agents might face, and a police situation in which they know they're going in for a psychiatric intervention.
Right, and I think that's an important distinction to understand. And there's no question that law enforcement in general at the local and county level has recognized the need to collaborate with mental health professionals, the need to integrate with the existing resources. The problem, I think, nationally is that the resources are so differing county to county, the availability of crisis intervention teams, state to state, the amount of resources that are placed in the Department of Mental Health to assist law enforcement in these activities. These are the kinds of factors that I think temper how well or how little training is made available to law enforcement, or more importantly, how much integration there is between the two communities. I think what has been a benefit to the major talked about
I have to interrupt to say that you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I apologize for
I'm
that.
I'm sorry.
But I did also want to ask that is there specialized training that now goes on to help officers who would be in a crisis situation, ATF agents, Secret Service agents, people like that, to recognize signs of someone who might be in a mental crisis?
Well, I can't speak for either of the agencies, but I am certainly aware that there are training programs made available to many federal agencies that involve this kind of knowledge, just like that information is made available at the state and local level. How those agencies then incorporate that in the very specific task assignments that they have, I think, is unique to the different agencies. But indeed, there is a specialized training that is made available to law enforcement at all levels of government, state, local, and federal.
As you look at it, what is the most critical factor in this situation? Because obviously, again, in a crisis, federal agents often have to make all kinds of law enforcement agents have to make split-second decisions.
Again, I would say, without commenting specifically on the case in Florida, it is all about context. When you are in a situation that requires very little tolerance in terms of the behavior of the subject in question, where an action must be taken because we have made a determination of risk. And basically that's what this is all about, how much risk can be tolerated. The ability to attenuate dialogue, the ability not to act, the ability to employ all of the techniques that may be learned in dealing with anyone who's exhibiting behavioral changes is going to be purely dependent on the circumstance. And when you're in a situation where there is time, where you're able to talk with the individual, where you're able to employ crisis teams, when you're able to employ family members, you're in a much different circumstance and perhaps a much better situation that may allow you to utilize these things and affect a better outcome than when you're in a situation that dictates an immediate response and very little tolerance for deviation from the protocol. That will always be the rate-limiting step.
Dr. Phillips, thanks very much for being with us today.
Quite welcome.
Dr. Robert Phillips, a forensic psychiatrist and professor of psychiatry and law at the University of Maryland. He's also a psychiatric consultant for the Protective Intelligence Division of the U.S. Secret Service, and he joined us by phone from his office in Annapolis, Maryland. When we come back from a short break, another take on the mental crisis and the mentally ill and air traffic, an apparent effort to screen out people described as mental defectives. We'll have more on that after the break. We'll also talk about the situation in Australia where riots have erupted in Sydney and your letters. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. For a different angle on public safety and the mentally ill, we welcome Jeff Stein to the program. He's National Security Editor for the Congressional Quarterly. He's with us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you back on the program.
Thanks, Neil.
You wrote a column this past week on a government contractor bid request from TSA, the Transportation Security Administration, the people who screen us going into airports. What exactly was the proposal?
Well, it's a pre-solicitation bid. It's called a sources sought, and it's a first step before they issue a request for contracts. And what they wanted the contractor to do is to do a number of security functions with a computer system and databases. And what they wanted to do is, for example, they said, we would like someone to look into military records and veterans records and scour them for mental defectives, quote-unquote, and they could be added to the no-fly or no-work lists at airports and on airlines.
How did they define mental defective?
Well, that's the question. I called up the Department of Defense and the Veterans Administration, of course, and they were a bit perplexed by this whole thing. But it turns out, according to a Pentagon spokeswoman I talked to, that there are internal records that list the circumstances of someone's termination from the military.
Mm-hmm.
And these are not on the discharge forms that are publicly available, but they are private Pentagon records that list various categories of quote-unquote mental defective.
So if you got discharged in what I guess used to be called a Section 8, that would be
that's right.
That would be listed somewhere. But
yep.
Are they allowed to release that information?
They're not supposed to. The question is whether they can get access to these files and scour them and use them privately so that someone would never even know that the TSA had access to these records, and that is not clear yet. I'm trying to get a clarification from the Transportation Security Administration, but they haven't returned my calls.
Mm-hmm. Now, we spoke with the TSA spokesperson yesterday, and he said that screening would only be used for workers such as hazmat truck drivers and not for airline passengers. Is that your understanding?
Well, it doesn't say that in the bid solicitation. It says registered travelers. This was part of the a TSA screening program where you can pre-register for travel, and so you can get through the lines.
The frequent flyer thing, yeah.
Sort of a frequent flyer thing, that's right. So, but anyway, I mean, if they're going to do all, it doesn't matter. I mean, if they're going to scour airport workers or passengers, whatever they're going to do, there's still, this principle is the same. If they want access to VA and Pentagon personnel records to find, quote-unquote, mental defectives.
And again, just to say that the Pentagon says no such category as mental defective exists.
Well, that was her first response, the spokeswoman, but then she emailed me to say, well, actually, there are records, but they are not releasable to the public. Now, I'm trying to get clarification on that, too. Mm-hmm. Does that mean they would still be releasable to or accessible to TSA to look for these so-called mental defectives?
Do you know if TSA plans to branch out into civilian databases to look for similar kinds of information?
Well, they have a much troubled program called Secure Flight, which is has presented a lot of problems for them, but just because of the privacy issue, they want access to credit card reports and so on, credit reports and so on. And a privacy group that TSA asked to study this question came back last week and said this thing needs to really to be entirely reworked. So there are lots of security programs going on at TSA, and this looks like another branch of the intrusion into people's lives. And so there's this balance. This is what's going on in Homeland Security in general, is this balance between security and freedom. And we find it clashing in all aspects of Homeland Security.
Jeff, come back when you have more on this, will you?
I sure will. Thank
okay.
you.
Jeff Stein, National Security Editor for Congressional Quarterly, who was kind enough to join us here today in Studio 3A.